Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN on this Veterans Day. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are tens of thousands of vets enjoying this holiday in the comfort of their own home. There are also thousands who are struggling with homelessness. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, there are about 2,800 homeless vets on any given day living in Florida. One of those used to be Ashley Esposito. She's a Navy veteran who's from Miami. After leaving the Navy, she eventually ended up back home, but she battled with emotional and physical challenges and then soon found herself homeless. That wasn't until she met Seth Eisenberg of the Sacred Trust, a group funded by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now she's finishing school and helping veterans get back into civilian life. We spoke to Esposito and Eisenberg about those challenges and about helping veterans. We've reached out to the South Florida Department of Veterans Affairs to confirm Ashley Esposito was employed with the organization and provided the opportunity for them to speak on our air. They confirmed Ashley's employment, but declined the opportunity to speak on the program.
When you're in the military and just say that you have housing problems, you can go take out a loan. They'll put you in base housing. There are so many options that you have as a military personnel. When you get out into civilian world, it's not like that. You know, you don't know where to go. You don't know who to ask for help. You don't know anything about government funding. There's no one telling you, oh, you can go here and get help because you're a veteran.
They don't prep you? They don't prepare you for what's coming next?
No, you go through a program called TAPS, and they tell you about all your medical benefits and things like that. But when I was in, there was nothing. I'm not sure now what they have now, but when I got out, there was nothing.
What did you want to do when you got back into civilian life? Where were your goals?
I wanted to be a chef. I love cooking. To this day, I have a family of chefs. My grandmother, my mother, we've always, like when I was growing up, we would sell dinners to like various businesses. Like that was our passion. I was the cook of my squadron. Everyone would ask me, hey, Ashley, could you make this for our squadron? And I would cook for 200 people by myself.
So everything seemed so promising.
Yes.
Life seemed promising. You were starting a new family, but then things started to unravel. You eventually ended up homeless. You were also dealing with a lot of physical pain and injuries.
Yes.
From your military service.
I could not become I started doing my chefing. That's what I call it. But then my back started killing me. And I was like, what's going on? I went to the doctor and I found out at 26 that I had arthritis in my back. So I even got a job with the Copacabana, the New York company where you see I Love Lucy and Ricky. I worked with them. I was helping design menus. They tried to open up a restaurant down here. I was working there, but I couldn't because my back was just, it felt like someone was stabbing me in my back.
You were in the hospital for a while at one point.
From having seizures.
And this is around the time when you eventually ended up homeless?
That was one of the times that I ended up homeless, yeah.
So the military gives you very basic preparation.
Mm-hmm.
You go through this TAPS program, which is the Tragedy Assistance Program for survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And here you find yourself in this situation, you're homeless. Where did you go? Who did you turn to?
I went to the VA. I was like, I need help. They gave me a sheet of paper of like 50 numbers to call. I'm going through this. I also have mental health issues that I'm trying to work with. I'm going there trying to get help. And me and my kids are homeless, and you want me to call 50 people.
So when you call the VA, wait, what did they give you?
They gave me a list. I went to the VA. They told me to go see my social worker. And this social worker has to deal with like 300 people. One social worker for each team. They have red team, blue team, geriatrics for the older people. And this person has to help every one of these people. So I went there. They was like, oh, yeah, we have programs. Take this list and just call them. And I was like, okay, this is going to take me forever. And then I started calling them. Oh, we have no funds. Oh, no, we only help with light bills. Oh, no, we only help with this. Oh, no, we only help with that. It was excruciating.
Seth, let me bring you in. You hear this story a lot.
I do.
I mean, you know, first of all, when someone like that comes in, someone like Ashley comes in and starts telling you her story, I mean, what's the first thing? What do you say?
I say, thank you, God, for bringing Ashley in. I think about the 20-plus veterans every single day who never make it in because they take their lives before they reach out for help. I think how lucky we are to have friends, family, and social supports that we can fall back on. So whether it's a medical issue or a career issue or a mental health issue, that we have people that can be there to help lift us up and help us sustain life.
And you hear her story and some of the things that were going on in her life, and she's dealing with, like a lot of veterans, mental health issues, physical pain and challenges, and then she ends up homeless. Are these the common things you see in veterans?
You see, veterans are a very diverse community. You know, there are millions of veterans out there. Each person has their own wishes, hopes, and dreams, their own passions. What they have in common is they've been through extensive training to be warriors. And that part of what people learn to be warriors is to be strong, which some people interpret as meaning don't be vulnerable. Act like everything's okay, which some people might interpret as when things aren't okay, don't tell anybody. You know, get your act together, where a lot of people say, if it's not really together, I'd rather die than let people know that. So that training is a common experience for the warriors who protect each of our families. What happens after the military is that people go through very human challenges. The challenges, the struggles, the barriers and roadblocks people run into, they're very normal. But when you add to that the training of a warrior and the idea that I have to keep it to myself, that I can't confide, that I can't say I don't know, that I don't know how to have the conversations with friends, family, and loved ones who might be able to be there for me. That's something that's a life and death issue for many people every day.
Where is the VA doing a good job, and where are they consistently, you know, challenged with problems?
So the VA, like any organization, is people that wake up and go through everything in life that other people go through. What someone like Ashley needed when she reached out was a team of people to be there for her. She was always ready to do her part, but she needed people that had the time, energy, and resources. What the VA does, and it's part of how Operation Sacred Trust came to be, is when the VA really looked at what was behind homelessness and how come the numbers were continuing to go up despite enormous investments within the VA, is they realized that every veteran needed an individual attention and support and services based on each veteran's unique wishes, hopes, dreams, passions, experience, and circumstances. So the VA started to fund public-private partnerships, and they allowed organizations like Operation Sacred Trust to reach out and say, here's what we would do, so that when Ashley reaches out, not only can we help her overcome the immediate challenge, but also not have to ever go through that again.
And so so people understand that the Sacred Trust, I mean, this is at your link to the VA, you're funded by the VA.
The VA has provided tens of millions of dollars of funding for agents, ours and other agencies in Florida, so that these public-private partnerships, which include the VA, can come together 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
I'm talking with Ashley Esposito, Petty Naval Officer, Third Class, and Seth Eisenberg, the president and the founder of the Sacred Trust. We're talking about the issue of homelessness among former service members. So you found Sacred Trust. You found Seth.
Yes.
When you met him, I mean, what happened?
I walked in the office, and I was crying with my two children. And he just happened to walk out. And he was like, what's the matter? Come sit down on this couch and talk to me. And I was like, no one's helping me. They fed me and my kids. And he was like, I'm going to be with you every step of the way. I'm not going to leave you until I know that you're okay. And it was like a guardian angel. Because finally, after all of these times, someone actually said, I'm going to help you. Not let me call you back. Not fill out this paperwork and we'll let you know in 48 hours or a week. You know, he was like, we're going to put you up in a hotel. It's okay. He was like, you're not going to have to cry anymore.
So Seth, tell us real quickly, how does the Sacred Trust help people like Ashley to make that transition into housing and into work and so forth.
So the moment Ashley comes to Sacred Trust, or any of thousands of other Ashleys that we're honored and privileged to serve, the first conversation is, what do you want for the future of your life? What's important to you? And then how do we put all of our resources together so that you now have a team of 25 people? So if you need legal supports, we have attorneys from the University of Miami that will give you legal supports. If you need help with the security deposit to move into housing, we have recent funds to provide security deposits. If you need a counselor to help you find the right neighborhood, where you want to live, where you want to work, we can do that. If you need job training, we can do that. What Ashley and others need when they reach out is a whole team of people to get to work for them. And when you think about it, it takes expertise to understand what resources are available in a community. And when someone's going through crisis or trauma, just saying, call this number or go to this address, that's usually not the answer.
Ashley, you went to work with the VA eventually.
I quit my job with Miami-Dade when I finally found a job to work at the VA because I got tired of seeing how nasty the people are. Like, those people, they talk to you any type of way. They have no passion for helping veterans. It's like, you know, they're federal government workers who is very hard to fire, and they shift people around when, just say, they make a mistake.
You understand how somebody on the outside hears that,
yes,
and we're thinking, wait a minute, but it's Veteran Affairs.
Yes.
It's supposed to be there for veterans, and you're saying there's a lot of dispassionate people.
It's like you're just another number. And I've told so many of them when I worked there, I said, if it was not for us, you wouldn't have this freedom of speech to speak to me the way that you are. And second of all, you wouldn't have a job, because your sole reason for being in that chair is to help a veteran. So if you can't do that, there's a lot of veterans and other civilians that want your job.
And when you were in there, were you trying to change things?
I did. I helped a lot of, especially the elderly veterans. I helped a lot of them. I helped a lot of the veterans who were prideful, because we're taught, do not come to the military with a problem without a solution. So I told them that they have to let that go and get help. I helped a lot get service connected. I helped them with getting prosthetic parts. I would go to their doctors and be like, listen, I need you to put in this console because this veteran needs help.
Is it the people or is it the system? You know, you go in and you had this experience and now you're trying to make things better, but is the system just needs to be tweaked so that more people would do the right thing, or is it just the people?
No, it's the system, because this is happening all over the United States. I just feel that what the VA really needs, for one, they need to target specific people. Like, I'm working very hard with a congressman, and I even met Ben Carson, because I want to set up a program that helps single parents get on their feet.
You were there for just a couple of years, though, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I was there for 2.5 years.
And we talk about that this is a problem nationwide. The census, looking at the census figures, we have about 2,700 homeless veterans right now in Florida. Seth, what do we know about where they are? What do we know about what's going on with them?
We know a lot about what's going on with them. Operation Sacred Trust, since 2010, has dealt with thousands of South Florida veterans who are either homeless or on the verge of homelessness. We have an amazing track record of ending homelessness in the lives of our veterans. Homeless veterans can be anywhere. What homeless veterans have in common is that they've gone through a crisis and there's no family, friends, or social supports to fall back on. But what we can do about it is each do our part.
Ashley, as a society, what is it that we need to be doing, better for veterans? I mean, you know, people will have probably come up and said, thank you for your service. You've probably seen people wear the ribbon. But what do those things mean? And really, what is it that veterans would prefer? What do we need to know better?
For one, when you say thank you for your service, that's really uncomfortable for us. Because we don't know, like, we're like, you're welcome. But, you know, we don't feel like heroes. We don't. And if you talk to any, like, veteran, they'll tell you, I was just protecting my country. But we don't feel like heroes. And when you come back to this country, you really don't feel like heroes, because you will be very surprised. You can have your hat on saying that you fought in the war. You may get two people to say thank you for your service, but there's not a lot of civilian people who are supporting veterans. And then when we tell a lot of people what we've been through, and this is the reason why we don't talk about our struggle, they're like, okay, and? You know, they don't understand that we left our families. We sat beside someone who didn't come back home. You know, we've seen a lot of tragedy for our country. So, you know, I feel that civilians need to have a little bit more sympathy, because at the end of the day, this is still the greatest country in the world to live in, and you should be thankful.
Ashley, thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate it. And Seth, thank you so much for sharing as well and everything that you do. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You heard from Ashley Esposito, Petty Naval Officer, 3rd Class, and Seth Eisenberg, the president and founder of the Sacred Trust. We've been discussing the challenges of helping end homelessness among veterans as a tribute on this Veterans Day. Well, still to come, we're going to talk to a civil rights legend that you may know very little about. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to this special edition of Sundial on WLRN on this Veterans Day. Dolores Huerta, one of the key civil rights leaders in the 1960s Chicano farm workers movement, lacks the recognition of many civil rights leaders of that era, like Cesar Chavez. Her name doesn't pop up much in school history books. Yet, she was an essential leader in protecting farm workers' rights. She helped coin the phrase, si se puede, yes we can, which still resonates with Latino communities today. Dolores, at 88, remains steadfast in her efforts to get Latinos to the polls to vote and is an important voice in the Me Too movement. During the midterm campaign season, she traveled to Arizona, Texas, Georgia, and Wisconsin. She also came to Florida, where we took some time to sit with her and talk about how much the country has changed and how much work remains.
I wanted to talk about some current events. Mm-hmm. President Donald Trump recently announced that he wants to end birthright citizenship. And this is an automatic right of citizenship granted in the Constitution to those born in the U.S., regardless of their parents' immigration status. What concerns should children of immigrants have over this threat?
Well, number one, we know it's unconstitutional. So in many ways, it's an empty threat. And he's doing this to kind of rev up his base. And I do believe that he's also trying to intimidate some people in the Latino community and other communities where you do have children that are born of undocumented people. In many ways, it's an empty threat, but I can see where many people would be really worried about this and concerned about this.
And this is an issue. Look, immigration's been an issue. But I'm wondering, in your time, have you ever seen immigrants' rights threatened to the extent by any other president you've ever seen?
Well, we have a history, unfortunately, a bad history of the way we treat immigrants. We know that back in the 30s, during the Depression, almost a million people, I think it was 800,000 people that were deported from the United States of America, and many of them who were. So we have seen that immigrants over the years have been treated very badly in our country. And it's unfortunate that now, when we have made so much progress in so many areas, that again we see that people are threatened. And it's people of color mostly. And this is just a continuing kind of a racial war that Trump is perpetuating. And we've seen the results of that, the anti-Semitic kind of propaganda that's out there, which results then with people getting killed, as we just saw in the synagogue in Pittsburgh, where people were killed. And so, I mean, this is really unfortunate. And I don't know what we have to do to wake up our president to make him understand that his rhetoric that he uses, the hateful rhetoric that he uses, is really causing damage. And I need to include, when I say that, what happened to the people in Puerto Rico, where you have maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people that died because they didn't get the assistance that they needed from our government, even though Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens.
After Hurricane Maria.
After Hurricane Maria, yes.
The president's threat of an executive order of ending birthright citizenship comes as we see this caravan of people traveling through Mexico to the United States. Do you see that caravan as an effective form of protest against the violence and the poverty that people are facing in Central American countries?
Well, I see it more as an effect of our wars that we conducted in Central America, the United States of America, where we were bombing people in El Salvador when we had the wars in Honduras. And, you know, we have never gone back to clean up the mess that we created. We spent a lot of American tax dollars on these wars, but we didn't spend American tax dollars to go back and help them with their economies. And one of the things I like to say when we talk about the people in Guatemala, for instance, and Honduras, and those people in Central America, I like to say the word bananas. How many bananas do we consume in the United States every year? Jillions of bananas, jillions of dollars. But that money doesn't go to the people in Guatemala. That money goes to Dole banana, it goes to Chiquita banana. It doesn't go to the people that produce that fruit that we Americans consume every day.
Florida's a big concern for the president. What role could President Trump's presence have, though, in motivating or perhaps convincing Latinos to not vote?
Well, we'll hope that his presence will actually motivate Latinos to vote, because we know that DeSantis has a reputation of attacking people of color. And especially when you think of Florida, you know, when you think of what happened in Orlando, where so many people were killed attending
the Pulse nightclub.
Yeah, at the because they were LGBT, and many of them were, we know, Latinos that were murdered in that shooting. And when we have the Parkland shootings that happen, when you have these courageous young people from Parkland that have gone out all over the country to advocate for gun control. So for the president to come here to Florida and then to bring some of his hateful rhetoric here, I mean, what does that add? And then now you have this person that mailed the pipe bombs who is also from Florida. So it's almost like Florida is ground zero for what's happening right now in the United States of America.
And you're talking about the arrest of Cesar Sayoc.
Cesar Sayoc. Yeah. And then the other thing, just to kind of throw it into the mix, is that you have so many of the Puerto Ricans that had to leave Puerto Rico because of the hurricane who are also now in the state of Florida. So you almost have that the state of Florida, when you look at it, it's kind of like a microcosm of what's happening in the United States of America. Because here, we have so many immigrants, you know, people from Cuba, people from Haiti, the Dominican Republic, people from Mexico, and of the Barbados Islands. And, you know, here is the picture of the United States of America right now in Florida.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself and some of your history and the role that you've played in making a lot of changes. In 2017, you had a documentary come out chronicling your life during the United Farm Workers Movement, Chicano Movement. You were a prominent figure in the 60s, but also very controversial. And then in Texas, in 2010, they take you out of the textbooks. Why was the Chicano movement and the role of Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers and people like you such an important part of the Latino experience in the United States? What was going on then?
Well, I think when you see the documentary Dolores, and I do hope people can see that, it's on PBS, public television, and Independent Lens. But what you see in that documentary is the power of poor people, the power of farm workers that were able to come together. It was Cesar Chavez and I organized those workers to come together, to go on strike, to go on marches, to do boycotts, to come out to the cities and get 17 million Americans to join them, to bring farm workers the basic human services that they needed, like toilets in the fields, cold drinking water, rest periods, and the right to organize in the state of California, and unemployment insurance, which unfortunately farm workers throughout the country do not have, only in California and Hawaii. But that, you know, this is the power of poor people. And this is, of course, what Cesar believed in, and what I, and with my own organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we know that poor people, once they know that they can come together in an organization and they take direct nonviolent action, that they can change things, not only for their families, but also for their communities. But that they have to understand that they have to do it. Nobody's going to do it for them. But they do have the power to change.
Do you think that we're teaching enough in schools about the Latino experience?
You know what? You hit the nail on the head. I mean, one of the reasons that we have so much ignorance that causes people like Mr. Cesar to do what he did in terms of sending pipe bombs and the other gentleman, well, not a gentleman, but the other person that murdered the people in the synagogue, is because they're ignorant. They don't understand the history of our country, the contributions of immigrants that have built this country. They don't understand the anti-Semitism that has existed throughout the world against the Jewish people. And if they knew, then they wouldn't do what they're doing now. So it's not about Latinos, but it's also about Africans that built our country as slaves, and the Native Americans that were killed in our country and were also slaves in our country. And if people would know this at all, and not only that, but about women also, the respect for women, the respect for our LGBT community, the respect for poor people and working people. These are all of the things that have to be taught in our schools so that we can have a country that is sane, where we don't have this discrimination and this bigotry and this hatred against one another.
And the person you were talking about is Cesar Sayoc. We have the Me Too movement now. And I wonder, do you see parallels between the Me Too movement today and what you saw in the 60s and coming up?
Well, I just want to make a reflection on the Me Too movement, because back in the 90s, I'm also on the board of the Feminist Majority Foundation, and we did a big campaign to get women to run. And we went to every little town, every community, and saying to women, one of you has to run. And we would meet with them and say, if you can't find somebody to run, one of you has to run. And they were like terrified to think of running for office. And we were kind of pulling teeth to get women to run. And all of a sudden here, because of Hillary Clinton, because of the fact that she won the election but lost the presidency, that now you see women coming in droves. And you have more women running for office right now in this election than any other time in the history of the United States. And they are getting elected. On this board that I'm on, the Feminist Majority, we believe in the feminization of power. And I always like to quote Coretta Scott King, who says, we will never have peace in the world until women take power. Although I have changed that to say, we will never have peace in the world until feminists take power, because that includes men also. Men who support women's reproductive rights and immigrants and care about the environment and our LGBT community.
You know, we see a lot of political activism this year from the youth, mm-hmm. and especially here in Florida, because this is linked to what we see with after the Parkland shooting. How is activism changing in the 21st century with things like social media? Because that really played a big role.
Well, I think that's exactly as you said, the social media, because it makes it so easier for people to connect with each other, to mobilize, to send out the messages. And so I do believe that the youth of our country are really going to be able to save our country. But the one thing, unfortunately, that many of our young people still don't understand the importance of voting. They think that with marches and with protests, that somehow that's going to make the difference. And it does make a difference in one respect, because you're educating people, you're getting out the message about what the issue is, you're bringing people together and they can feel their power. But you've got to take that march to the ballot box, because at the end of the day, the people that we elect are the ones that make the laws, and they make the policies that affect all of us. And if we don't get people elected, nothing changes. Or, as we know now, things can get a lot worse.
Dolores Huerta, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Si se puede.
That was civil rights activist and labor organizer Dolores Huerta. That was a conversation we had with her during the midterm election as she campaigned in key states to galvanize the Latino vote. Well, still to come, a murder case in a small Florida tourist town. The author of the book even became a suspect, sort of. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Hello and welcome to this Veterans Day edition of Sundial on WLRN. The case of Sabine Musso Buehler is likely unknown to many Floridians, but it has the makings of a quintessential Florida true crime story. Musso Buehler owned a hotel on Anna Marie Island, a tourist destination just off the coast of Sarasota in western Florida. In November 2008, Musso Buehler's hotel caught fire and she went missing. Her body wasn't recovered for years later. The case is the premise behind a new true crime novel from writer Cutter Wood. A writing student at the time at the University of Iowa, Wood spent his time traveling between college and Anna Marie Island, interviewing residents, friends of Sabine, and even her boyfriend. At one point, Wood was even questioned by police. Love and Death in the Sunshine State is one of the featured novels at the Miami Book Fair this year. Wood spoke to us from the studios of NPR in New York before his event at the book fair November 18th.
You know, it's kind of strange. So I'd been down there visiting with some family, and just by chance, I stayed at this little motel right on the beach and didn't really think much of it. And then not long after I left, I get this article from my mother that shows this motel just in flames. You know, somebody set fire to the thing. And as I started looking at the story, this woman who had owned the motel, who I think I'd met when I was there, she had just vanished not long before. And I started to kind of keep tabs on the story, and it just really captivated my attention because of what it was doing to the community down there. You know, it's this very, very small island. Not a lot of people live there. And people just started hallucinating seeing this woman everywhere. You know, they thought they saw her at the dentist's office or walking down the street looking disheveled and upset. Somebody thought they saw her getting on a flight to Costa Rica. One woman I remember thought that Sabina, this missing woman, was going to get in touch with her through a parrot from the afterlife. You know, so I was really so sucked into the extreme reactions people were having to this woman's disappearance that I decided to go down there and have a look for myself. And I thought maybe, you know, I'd write like a short essay or article about it. And then I get down there and it's this very beautiful tourist beach, you know, one of the kind of most popular tourist beaches in Florida. And the detectives have a backhoe out there and cadaver dogs and professors of archaeology. And they're just digging it up looking for a body. And it was just so surreal. You know, all these tourists are there. They're not, you know, they have their chairs out, but they're not looking at the ocean anymore. They're kind of gathered around this hole waiting to see if a body comes up. And, you know, the second I saw that, I knew I had to write more about it.
Now, you were a student at the University of Iowa while you were investigating this case and starting to work on the story. Talk about the dichotomy between, you know, those two worlds. I mean, you're a student, but you're working on this, a murder case. I mean, you're trying to get to the bottom of the story, and you didn't even know who the killer was.
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing in the world, actually. You know, just geographically strange, you know, go from January in Iowa with 6 feet of snow on the ground and head down to Florida for a week to interview somebody in prison. And then come back and start teaching your own classes in creative writing. The weirdest part and the thing where I, you know, you kind of get interested in the story, but you're not quite sure what about your own place in it. And the part where I realized that I was actually, you know, a part of this story myself, I got back after one of those visits to Florida and I was teaching one of my classes and I got this call from the university police asking me if I could just come down by the police station for a second and chat. Had no idea what this is about. You know, I thought maybe I got like a parking ticket or something like that. I didn't really realize. I get down there and it's really hard to take this police station seriously. You know, it's just a couple of rooms near the Buffalo Wild Wings in the mall. And these two university police officers take me back into one of the back rooms and they start asking me about this missing woman in Florida, this Sabina Musil Bueller.
Wait a minute. And they started interrogating you?
They started interrogating me, exactly. I didn't even realize at the time. You know, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around what's going on. How did they hear about her, all this stuff? And I realized, you know, they're grilling me for an alibi, basically. And I finally kind of put together what had happened. That, you know, I'd been down there, I'd been interviewing all these people. I had reached out to the detectives in Florida who were investigating this case, but hadn't actually been able to get through and interview them yet. But they, in their own research, had realized that I had been talking to people that they wanted to talk to. And so they just kind of put in a call to these university police asking if they could get in touch with me and put me in touch with them. But they didn't really say anything more than that. They just said, you know, there's this guy Cutter Wood there at the university. We want to talk to him about a homicide.
But at no point they made that you were a suspect.
They never mentioned that to these guys. These guys just kind of took it into their own heads that they were going to collar a homicidal maniac. And, you know, it was just having just been interviewing all these people and interviewing this guy who was kind of thought to be a very prime suspect in the disappearance. It was so strange then to have the table suddenly flipped, you know, wow. And to find yourself in the hot seat.
Wow.
And then, I mean, too, maybe the weirdest and most disconcerting thing for me was just to realize how disappointed these two university police officers were when they realized I was not a killer. You know, they were really excited by the idea that, you know, they could stop ticketing bicycles and actually bring in a criminal.
I laugh, obviously, you know, because of the absurdity of the fact mm-hmm. that they pulled you in. This is a tragic story. One of the central characters in the book and a central suspect in Sabine's murder is Bill Cumber. What was your impression of Bill when you first met him?
Maybe it would help if I just kind of gave a little bit of an idea of the kind of number of people who are involved here. There were three guys who were kind of considered persons of interest by the sheriff's department. And they were this man who'd been found driving Sabina's car a few days after she disappeared. She had a husband at the time who she was still living with, but they had kind of a weird situation at home where they'd actually divided their house perfectly in two, and she lived on one side and he lived on the other. And then she also had this boyfriend, William Cumber. And when I first went to meet Bill, he was kind of being shuffled around between different prisons in Florida at the time. He'd been sent back to prison for a different crime. And he was then being held at this prison up in Chipley near Tallahassee. And it was just the entire experience was so otherworldly. You know, I drove up there. It was, I think, one of the coldest days ever in Florida. And I had to spend the night in my car, and I was just freezing on the drive there. The entire state was worried about losing their strawberry crop. And I get up there, and of course, this prison is not prepared for that kind of cold either. And like all of the inmates are shivering. And I sit down across from Bill. And, you know, you kind of build up in your head this idea of who this person is going to be. And I'd seen all these pictures and read all of these different, you know, prior criminal case documents. And I had this kind of idea of this kind of swashbuckling, handsome, possibly murderer. And instead, it was just this very, very cold, very kind of frumpy and distracted man who shuffled out from the back in socks and flip-flops. And it was really hard to...
But did you think he was the killer? Or did you have any reason to think so?
At that time when I first met him, I really wasn't sure. You know, as time went on and little bits of evidence began to surface and I felt like I was seeing inconsistencies in his story, I started to feel like there was a better possibility. At that time, though, I really had no idea. I was just, he was at that time the last person who had seen Sabina alive, is what everybody knew. And I was just curious to talk to him and find out about her and find out about what had happened between them.
Now we come back to Bill because, you know, Bill Cumber, and some of your correspondence with him was through letters from prison. What other insight did those letters give you into his character? I mean, you met him, but did you get anything else from perhaps his writing?
Yeah, so he turned out to be quite a prolific writer and reader. And in fact, those letters are still coming to this day. I guess the biggest thing which I noticed when we first started speaking and also in the letters was just that he was somebody of pretty high ups and downs. You know, I remember when we spoke that first day, we'd talk and he kind of seemed distracted, and then we would strike onto some subject where he would just get more and more mentally involved in it until he was actually kind of gripping the table between us as he talked about it. And the letters kind of showed that sort of up and down as well, you know, where one week I would get a letter saying, hey, you know, very friendly, very casual, very normal letter. And the next week would be a letter all in caps saying something like, I am not bipolar. All in capital letters just as the beginning of the letter.
Was your family or any of your friends or anybody just concerned about the fact that you had this connection, this weird connection, this developing connection with this lead murder suspect?
Oh, yeah. Try my wife for concern. And, something about going to the mailbox and coming back with a letter from a murder suspect just doesn't thrill anyone. She would go out and get the mail and come back and drop them on the counter, just silently, which you always know is a bad sign, right?
Oh my goodness.
But they took it pretty well, you know. I think they were willing to bear with me through the process, maybe is just the best way to put it.
I'm speaking with Cutter Wood. He's the author of the new book, Love and Death in a Sunshine State, The Story of a Crime. It follows a true story, the mysterious death of hotel owner Sabine Musil-Bueller on Anna Marie Island. Cutter will be a featured author at the Miami Book Fair this year. You were writing this book for a number of years, 6 years, I believe. Was there ever a point where you felt too close to everything and you wanted to quit? I mean, you know, think about the detectives that put you in that position. Did you ever feel like, I'm out?
There are tons of moments. Maybe the most striking, I guess, is... So I had, very much towards the end of the project, when I thought I was done, was the moment when I really thought hard about whether or not I wanted to even continue with this. So I'd been working on the book, I guess, for about 5 years then. And there had been virtually no movement in this case for that time. You know, it seemed like it was just going to be a cold case forever. One of the lead detectives had retired, come back from retirement because this case was still driving him crazy, and then retired again, which just shows you kind of the hopelessness of it. And then, so, you know, I had this entire book project going, and I kind of just determined I'm just going to write it as though there is no resolution. That itself is kind of a way to finish this thing. So I sent off this manuscript, I think it was October 15th, 2015. I think around 10 in the morning, I sent it off to my agent saying, you know, I'm done. It's either this or it's nothing. And I send that off to him. I hop on the internet, just kind of check news down in Anna Maria. And the case has been resolved.
Right as you sent in the manuscript, you didn't know there was a resolution.
Within 15 minutes.
Oh my God.
So I just hop on my email and hey, just want to send you a quick update. Turns out I need to rewrite the entire book. And that was certainly a moment when I thought hard about whether or not I really wanted to keep going with this thing.
That was the thing that compelled you to do it.
You know, in the end, once I said, okay, I'm gonna keep after this. That was like the turning point. I was like, okay, we're just gonna push through. I ended up I flew down to Florida, and the person who had, you know, who they determined was guilty of the crime. By that point in time, I had a close enough relationship with him that I went to visit him in the Manatee County Jail. And we sat down for a little over a week, just every single day. And he gave me the moment by moment of falling in love with this woman and up through the day of actually committing the crime, you know, and finding himself capable of something he never thought he could do. And that was, well, I think it's kind of what gives the book its power, you know, this kind of direct, raw account of the experience. That was really tough. And I don't think there was a day that week when I didn't think about kind of throwing in the towel and just moving on to something new and lighter.
Did the experience of writing this challenge your notions of romance and your connection with your wife?
Absolutely, you know, because you sit down across from this guy who's telling you about killing the woman he loved. And, you know, when you start to get into the minute details of what made this relationship fall apart, they're so mundane, you know, and they're so everyday. It's just like the kind of stuff that drives everybody crazy in their own relationship, right? You know, things like disagreeing about what to have for dinner or not liking each other's friends or somebody won't do the dish in the sink and it's not clear whose dish that is. Like, I could not help but reflect on my own relationship as we're talking. And so, to me, it was all about learning to be a more patient boyfriend at first, now husband, and really continually considering my own place in the relationship. And so, in my mind, despite the fact that this is largely a story about a murder, it's also a love letter to my wife about me trying to continually be a better person.
You've been down here enough times now, and, you know, I mean, you know, in Florida, we look at authors like Carl Hiaasen, who've made a career off of true crime in the state. And I'm just, your experience, I'm curious, what do you think? What is there something about Florida, you know, that makes it this setting for crime stories so compelling? You know, what is it about true crime genre in the state of Florida?
Well, I mean, I am not an expert on this, but I've certainly thought about it a lot. And the thing, one of the things that I think is most unique about Florida, though there are a lot of things, is how many people in Florida aren't from Florida. You know, it's this place that people go because they dream about what Florida will be like. You know, the two main characters in this book, the woman was from Germany, the man was from Ohio. And in that way, it is such a typical Floridian story of these two people who dream of a better life somewhere else, temporarily find it together there in Florida, and then realize that the Florida that they had in their minds is not at all the Florida of reality. And to me, that's part of the reason that Florida has all of these kind of zany stories, is it's this place that people, where their imagining of the place almost overwhelms their reason.
Cutter Wood, man, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate the time, man.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
That was Cutter Wood. He's the author of the new book, Love and Death in the Sunshine State, The Story of a Crime. It follows a true story, the mysterious death of hotel owner Sabine Musso Bueller on Anna Marie Island. Cutter will be a featured author at the Miami Book Fair. He'll be speaking Sunday, November 18th. Well, that's Sundial for this Veterans Day, Monday, November 12th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Well, coming up tomorrow on Sundial, a photo exhibit about Miami's 80s crime spree, an update on the Beckham Soccer Stadium, and a chat with Scott Cunningham from Oh Miami about his new book of poetry. That's the program. Remember, you can find us online, WLRN.org, or on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Don't forget to download the podcast, subscribe, and share. Just again, find us on iTunes, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Veterans Day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.